Welcome to Clear Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples. On today's podcast, we have the pleasure again of discussing science with Rabbis Elie Feder and Aaron Zimmer. Elie is a mathematician and Aaron's a physicist and hosts of the Physics to God podcast. Welcome again, Elie and Aaron.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure.
Wonderful. Well, we had a great time last week. And Ken, we're continuing a discussion we started on the last podcast. Bring us up to and tell us what ground we're going to cover today.
Yeah, we had such a great time talking about science and faith. And I want to continue to hear their perspective on various science issues. So I've come up with a number of good questions, I think. And I know that our listeners consider this a real honor. So to both of you, thank you so much for being willing to come on and talk about these great ideas.
Sure.
Our pleasure.
Well, let me begin with a kind of a comparison here. Evangelical Christianity, I think, kind of struggles at times with anti-intellectualism. I think some evangelicals think that, you know, the head can kind of get in the way of the heart. But when I look at Judaism, it seems that even while the religion is tiny compared to Christianity, Islam, or Hinduism, it just seems that Judaism has a deep riches when it comes to the intellectual areas of life. I mean, some of the great scientists, engineers, mathematicians, physicians, scholars in various fields. I wonder how you explain that. And am I right to think that that educational emphasis maybe comes out of the, you know, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament? I'd just like to hear you speak to that topic.
Okay, great question, Ken. So there's a few answers, but for starters, I think it's not, there exists this, I guess, conflict sometimes in the Jewish sphere as well. There are, I think especially because, again, as Aaron talked about last time, is modernity threatens religion. And there are a lot of people, scientists, atheists, who kind of use science to say that science disproves God. And I think people, religious people, are often skeptical of that, and they kind of shy away from science and because of those fears. So it does exist in Judaism as well. At the same time, I think there is a truth to the fact that we are, Judaism is a, has a strong tradition of a commitment to knowledge. And it reminds me of a quote by Albert Einstein, where I don't remember exactly the quote, but he said something to the fact that he thanks his lucky stars for being part of a tradition that values knowledge for its own sake. And this is an idea which is, again, Albert Einstein was not a religious Jew in any way, but at the same time, he was touching on something which is a core idea in Torah, in Judaism. And there's something we think called Torah Lishma. That means Torah, learning for its own sake. And there's an idea is that we have a long tradition of valuing learning, studying, learning. And in a certain sense, like Maimonides says, it's like the primary relationship we have with God and love of God is through knowledge, through studying, whether it's studying the universe, which he created and seeing all the wisdom, or studying the Torah and the wisdom he revealed to us in the Torah. And that's, in a certain sense, every day we make blessings for the fact that God gave us the Torah and commanded us in this command. And we cite a statement which says, lists a bunch of different commandments. And it says, in a certain sense, Talmud Torah, learning corresponds to all of them. So there's a great emphasis throughout our history on the scholar, the rabbi, the learning as being a root, and it's sort of the primary root for us to recognize and form a relationship with God.
Right.
Well, that's wonderful. I hope the Christians can learn from that great tradition. And there certainly are parts of Christendom that I think are, you know, very dedicated to the mind. Sometimes evangelicalism a little bit less.
I just add one thing is, sure. As you're mentioning, like the wisdom literature, like I'm assuming like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Joe, maybe
Psalms, yeah.
My opinion is that I think it's really the intellectual bent of Judaism comes much more from the oral Torah, the Talmud. And I really think that's where Jews throughout the ages, the millennium really, has spent the majority of our intellectual efforts and time. It's really in studying the Talmud. And it's a very rigorous method of analysis and deals with conceptual categories. And there's the specifically the last 150 years, something developed by Reb Chaim Brisker called the Brisker methodology, which helps us analyze things. And I think that the methodology of the it's called Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah and the interpretation of scripture, that's the method, the methodology and the intellectual approach that transfers the most to science and mathematics and philosophy and all the other areas of thought. It really comes from the oral Torah. That's, I think, where really you'll see the best transfer from there to other areas.
Now, would you define the Talmud as a commentary on the Torah? Would that be a general definition for it?
It's the Talmud is really a commentary on the Mishnah. And in a certain sense, you can call the Mishnah an elaboration of the five of the Torah, the five books of Moshe. It's taking the five books of Moses, and it's the Mishnah is the set of laws that the 613 commandments, and then the Talmud comments on that. So in a certain sense, yeah, it all does go back to the written Torah, the five books of Moses, but the specific method of extrapolating from the five books of Moses in order to get the law, that's really, it's like an oral tradition that was passed down for thousands of years.
Well, great. Here's another question. Arno Penzias, who I believe is a religious Jew, he, of course, with his colleague Robert Wilson, received the Nobel Prize discovering the background radiation of the Big Bang. And he had a remarkable quote that I've always been fond of. I've included it in a couple of my books. He said, "The best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I had nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole." I wonder how that strikes you as both scientists and Jews, and does that kind of idea clash with, kind of our contemporary world?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, I think for starters, I think there's some truth to it, but it's somewhat of an exaggeration, of course. I don't think, obviously by just looking at, the five books of Moses and Psalms, one's not going to predict quantum mechanics or general relativity or even the rigorous mathematics, which is built into our universe. So, but at the same time, while again, I think it is an exaggeration, at the same time, there is a certain truth, which is, as I think Aaron talked about this last time, is there's an age-old debate about whether the universe is eternal, as Aristotle maintained, or it had a beginning, as is in Genesis 1, the fact that there was a creation. And this is something which was an open question and was highly debated. And even if Aristotle believed in a God, and for example, the Maimonides, who talked about it, he believed in God, but he says, nevertheless, there's this question which wasn't really able to be proven. And Aristotle argued that the universe was eternal, and Maimonides goes to great lengths to show that Aristotle never proved it. And he said that it's the position of the Torah that there is a creation. At the same time, again, this was an open question. No one really had any proof positive that this was the case. And I think, again, that's what I think Penzias is referring to, the discovery of the background radiation. He's saying the Big Bang is ostensibly, of course, there are still those who debate it, but ostensibly an indication that, in fact, the universe did have a beginning. And that's, that is what it, maybe what he's, one aspect of what he's referring to is that, in a certain sense, modern science has confirm the prediction, so to speak, of the Torah. So that's definitely one point. Another thing he might mean, and this is another idea, which is when he's talking about Psalms, throughout Psalms, you find King David is talking about the heavens declare the glory of God. And he talks all about, in a certain sense, you could say it's like a preliminary form of a design argument, where he's always talking about how the different the wonders that are found throughout nature, whether it be in the life, throughout life and the biology and the lions, and whether it be the wind and the snow and the heavens, the stars. And in a certain sense, the way King David views that, he sees in the unbelievable design in the universe, the handiwork of God, the creator. And in that sense, I think that's also been an idea. This idea of a design argument has been prevalent throughout the ages. And it's gone throughout our, you know, rabbis, and again, that goes in Christian and in Muslim literature. Also, this is an ancient argument, and I think it's that argument. And this is largely what we talk about in Physics to God. That argument takes on much more rigor, if you will, when you study it through the lens of the discoveries of modern physics, through fine tuning, through the design of the laws, through the entropy, the highly ordered initial conditions of our universe. So in that sense, I think it does, you know, echo the sentiments which are found throughout the five books of Moses and King David. But again, only up until, obviously one can't learn science from studying the Torah.
Now, Aaron, many Christians talk about what they call creation ex nihilo, that God called all things into being from non-existence. And there are Christian commentators who look at Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And they interpret that expression, heavens and earth, as the totality of all things. Do Jews see it that way? Is Genesis 1:1 kind of a creation ex nihilo general statement? Or is that more of a Christian interpretation?
No, that's definitely the, I would say, classic Jewish interpretation. And pretty much everybody, all Jews, I think, interpret the word is bara,
yeah.
Brachis bara Elokim. So bara is the word that you for creation from nothing. The other Hebrew words of like are asa and yatzar, and those are creation of something from something. But Genesis 1:1, the word there is clearly bara, and it's everybody's throughout the ages has always, all Jews have always interpreted that as creation of something from nothing, for sure.
Great. Great. Let me transition a bit here to mathematics. It seems to me that over the last couple hundred years, scientists have recognized the remarkable correspondence between abstract mathematics, so equations, with the universe, so much so that I've always quoted Eugene Wigner in his journal article, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And he even uses the word miracle. Now, I know he was maybe an agnostic or an atheist, so he didn't mean it maybe the way I would or you would, but it is a remarkable thing. I remember taking a physics course in college, and what struck me as a student of philosophy was, how is it possible that Einstein's conceptual mathematical ideas actually matched the physical universe? That's what struck me. It was more of a philosophical excitement that I saw. So I want you to, Ellie, your background is in mathematics. Do you think math points to God? Do you agree with Wigner here? How strong do you think you can make an argument that there's something unique about the universe and mathematics?
Right. That's a good question. You know, it reminds me a little bit of a quote that Einstein said, something, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is the fact that it is comprehensible. And it is true that it's shocking that it is comprehensible and that we could probe the depths of the universe using mathematics. At the same time, while again, I share that sentiment, I don't know. I don't really think it's super convincing, because when we talk about evidence for God, I think we have to consider what the alternative theory is. In other words, for example, we say that we see the Big Bang, for example, and we say that indicates that there is a beginning. So one may argue, as like a common cosmological argument would say, well, that must mean there's a cause for this universe, and that's, we say, is God. And that's true. That's one argument. But I think the physicist, for example, Stephen Hawking, says something like this, is that the laws of nature themselves, quantum physics itself, predicts that nothingness is unstable, and somehow the laws themselves generate our universe, generate a Big Bang. So a beginning, maybe a physicist would agree there's a beginning. The question is, well, what caused that beginning? Is it God, one simple existence, necessary existence, which caused that, the Big Bang? Or is it a set of complex laws of nature, quantum mechanics, general relativity, which caused this this universe to result? So, and those laws, again, those are the laws of nature, are a mathematical form. They're a beautiful set of equations or two sets of equations, and they take on a mathematical form. And I think for a physicist or for someone like Hawking, he would say, those laws are at the core of reality. That's what exists. And if you'll say, well, what created those laws? He'll probably just say, well, I don't know, what created God? And then we would say, oh, God's necessary existence. At some point, you come to the bottom of the line and say, this is the baseline of reality. This is not a contingent existence, but it's a necessary existence. And we're going to say that by God. He's going to say that when it comes to the laws of nature, which take on this mathematical form. At the same time, that being the case, I think the core argument, and this is why we go with this type of argument, the argument from fine-tuning, from design, from the ordering initial conditions, is that when you get down to the core of those laws of nature themselves, they exhibit sign, they're complex, and they're multiple parts which are put together. There's the qualitative laws, and there's the quantities in those laws, and there's the initial conditions which the universe began. And all those indicate signs of intelligence. The constants are fine-tuned to be just the right in order to reproduce our universe. The laws are just right. They're not just mathematical, but they're specific laws which lead to unfolding into our amazing universe. The initial conditions, the highly ordered low entropy initial conditions, were set in a way that unfolds to be able to result in our complex ordered universe. So when you're pitting the two theories of one simple God versus a complex set of laws, the complex set of laws itself has these different parts which indicate they're designed, and somehow they're put together, and that points to an intelligence. When you have multiple components which are so arranged and fine-tuned and ordered to be able to bring about a whole which is that much greater than their individual components, that points to intelligence. And as opposed to the idea of one God who doesn't have any parts, it doesn't beg that question of who designed God, because God is one and he's simple, he doesn't have any parts. And that's why I think the complexity, the order of the universe does point to God and point away from the theory of these laws being necessary existence. As opposed to, again, just the mathematics alone, I think I'm not sure that would impress somebody who wants to hold the intrinsic necessary existence of these laws of nature.
Aaron, thoughts about that?
I largely agree with what Ellie's saying. If you're trying to like really prove the existence of God from the fact that the laws of nature are mathematical, I think it's a harder argument to make, because like, what is the alternative? That the laws should be mathematically inconsistent laws? Like, it's hard to imagine what would that even mean, mathematically inconsistent laws, or would it mean that there's no quantities? Once you have quantities, then you can have equations, and theory should be mathematically consistent. So it's hard to conceive of the opposite. But I do think that, like, there is like a sense, it's like an abstract sense that you see physicists talking about. You're mentioning Wigner, but I remember seeing, I think Paul Dirac, one of the great quantum physicists, who even the other great quantum physicists like respected Dirac, and he was a real atheist, but he still said God is a mathematician, and he came up with he still says that, and they. He came up with the Dirac equation, but there is this incredible sense that there is something. It's not just laws are not just mathematically consistent, but they are these incredibly beautiful, simple, elegant mathematical laws, which is beyond. It's more than just mathematically consistent equations. They are the unbelievable mathematical structures, and from those simple, elegant mathematical structures comes this complex universe, with the whole diversity and everything is regulated in exact ways. And the only ways you can even describe it is because the mathematics allows us to follow the initial equations to these far-reaching conclusions and consequences. The orbit of a planet that comes from these, fundamental law like gravity. So there is something about that. And I think that what you're talking about, the this appeal to mathematics and the beauty and the simplicity of mathematics that's inherent in the laws, that's like more part of an argument that the laws of nature are themselves designed in order to have like these simple, beautiful, elegant mathematical laws, such that these laws would yield a universe that's complex and beautiful. But I think it's really a design argument, and the mathematical aspect of it is a component of a design argument in the laws of nature itself.
Ellie, I appreciate very much your comment that, you know, what is the alternative on the other side? In teaching logic, I'm always encouraging my students, have you considered the best argument, you know, on the other side of the coin? Joe, I'd like you to jump in at this point. Do you have a question, or would you like to take one of these questions?
Yeah, I can take the next one.
Okay.
We have a list of 7 questions, and based on how fluid and wonderful the content has been, seems like we can go on with many more after that. But anyway, we'll keep it to 7. Some secular scientists who affirm naturalism have proposed that the universe has no purpose. In 2012, the Templeton Foundation asked this question to astrophysicist and popular science communicator Neil deGrasse Tyson. In a short video available on YouTube, Tyson explained his answer. He's not sure if the universe has a purpose, but he asserts that, quote, anyone who expresses a more definitive response to the question is claiming access to knowledge not based upon empirical foundations, end of quote. Yet he ends the video by confidently declaring that, quote, the case against it having purpose is strong and visible to anyone who sees the universe as it is rather than as they wish it to be, end of quote. All right, well, there's the response from deGrasse Tyson. What do you guys think?
So purpose is, it's a tricky issue. And it's like so important to us as human beings, the whole issue of purpose. It's really central to the whole question about science, especially that we discuss. I think you have to really, there's a very important distinction you have to make when you're trying to think about purpose with regards to the universe. And that's, are you speaking about the purpose of the entire universe? Or are you speaking about purpose within the universe, of one part of the universe relative to another? Okay, I think that's like the most important distinction. So let me explain that a little bit. Is if you're trying to say, what is the purpose of the entire universe? Meaning, why did God make something? Why is there anything? So you're really asking for the purpose of everything created. And purpose must make recourse to something in order to make sense to us, to be justifiable. It must make recourse to something outside the very system you're trying to explain. So when you're dealing with the purpose of the entire universe, everything created, the only thing that's left to justify that is God himself. And you're not going to be able to get any better answer than what is the purpose of it all other than God, meaning God did it, God wants it. That's the will of God. God and his will are one, something along those lines. Essentially saying this is what God wants. He wants to create something. There is no logical way to be able to give an answer other than God's will. You're basically going to have to make recourse to God. And you can understand why you can't do more than that when you're dealing with the universe as a whole. But within the universe, you can't have purpose from one component of the universe to another. For example, that's essentially the entire argument we make on the podcast. We're arguing that the laws of nature, the constants of nature, they have a purpose. The reason why the constants have specific values or the qualitative laws of quantum mechanics and general relativity exist is because they exist for a purpose in order to produce a universe with galaxies and stars and planets and life and molecules and atoms and all the complex, diverse existences that you see in the universe, you know, the physical universe, that you can have. You can say that the explanation for the values of the constants is for the purpose of producing a star. That's, you're dealing with two created things, a law or a constant and a star. Then you can have purpose. You can have, you know, on Earth, they, for example, you know, that was the, you know, do plants exist for the purpose of animals? That's obviously getting, it's getting more complicated how exactly you you figure out. It's not so easy to figure out what the purpose of one thing is, when one thing is serving something else, when it's simply an accident that exists. It's a tricky question, but you could have purpose within the universe of one thing to the other. But if the question is, what's the purpose of the universe as a whole? That's a completely different question philosophically. And that's really not going to be answerable anything other than it's God's will. But for, you know, usually what people are concerned about in terms of purpose is, you know, do I have a purpose? What's the purpose of humanity? What's the purpose of my life? And that's something, once you show that their purpose exists within the universe, like we do on Physics to God, to show that there is an objective grounding for a purpose, teleology, teleological causes. Once you show that has a real objective metaphysical background of the laws for the purpose of galaxies and stars and planets and life, including life, then you can, that sets the foundation for introducing a purpose for humanity or for individuals to develop that further and to investigate and trying to find, you know, using other sources of evidence to figure out what your purpose is, things like that. That makes sense. And it helps to have a real objective grounding for that from science.
Just to I guess, summarize or clarify. So it's not clear exactly what deGrasse Tyson is referring to in the quotes, but if he's saying is like the whole category of purpose is not, there's no evidence for it. And it sounds like he's suggesting that someone's just put that in, the whole idea of purpose, there's no basis or observational, I forget exactly what he said, but something, there's no basis in observations or empirical reality for such a claim. I think that's where our argument is that no, that's not true. When you see design, order, fine tuning, you find these constants of nature, and these were a mystery. How do we explain these constants? And this is a mystery that went back to Feynman and QED, and he asked, what's this? The big one he called it the biggest damn mysteries of physics. How do you explain the values of these constants? Numbers like 137.13599137, things like this. These are, how do you explain these numbers? And then there was this discovery of fine-tuning, that they're not just the plain old numbers, any old numbers like Feynman thought or like physicists had thought, but these numbers are specifically tuned in a way which allows the future emergence of everything about our universe when it comes to, again, planets and galaxies and molecules and atoms and life and stars. And once you see that, that indicates that the cause of these values is the future, the emergence, the purpose of bringing about everything our complex universe. And in that sense, that idea of purpose is indicated by the discovery of fine-tuning of design of low entropy of the ordered initial conditions. So in that sense, the basis of purpose is indicated, but then to get further into, okay, so what's the purpose of man? That I don't think science is gonna get us to that point. That's where maybe we're gonna have to turn towards religion or towards other sources to be able to find that. But the fact that there is such an idea of purpose, that there's an intelligent cause to our universe, and indicates the concept of purpose of teleology built into our universe, that is indicated by science. And that's a big step that gets the ball rolling to be able to ground the search for purpose of man's life.
You know, Joe, as I listen to Ellie and Aaron speak, I kind of chuckle to myself because I think they fit perfectly in our lunchroom discussions here at RTB. Joe, go ahead and ask the next question.
Yeah, here's another one about consciousness. The quote is from philosopher Joshua Rasmussen. Consciousness cannot emerge from AI, but AI can emerge from consciousness. What are your basic thoughts about AI and how do you react to this statement?
So that's... You know, AI really, it does, it's the hot topic now. Consciousness has been the hot topic for thousands of years. AI, I guess, is changing that a little bit. I think the first place to start when you're dealing with consciousness is the fact that it's hard to really know what consciousness is, how it works, its relationship to the brain, to physical matter. It's just one of these, you know, modern science is incredible and it's opened up so many areas of knowledge, you know, on Earth and in outer space and in the human body, everything. But it really has done like almost nothing when it comes to explaining consciousness or how we know things in terms of, you know, really the human mind. And it's especially the subjective element of it. It just, modern science has really shed very little light on that. So it's hard to really know how to think about consciousness and the effect of AI on that whole discussion. But I would just say is that I think in general, the bigger problem AI poses, I think it's more of a psychological problem for people. That what makes humans unique and special is our intelligence that we're able to think and think abstractly and perceive deeper realities. And if you see an artificially intelligent computer or whatever doing things like that, it makes you feel like, well, we're not so special anymore. But I hear that might be psychologically disturbing, but I don't think ultimately it really impacts on any kind of really religious issues. For example, I think if you found if we discovered intelligent aliens that are more intelligent than human beings, psychologically that would affect us. That would bother us. We wouldn't be the smartest things in the universe. It would definitely bother a lot of scientists. I know that, but it's it's not gonna have any impact. The religion, the Torah doesn't say anything, about whether other intelligent beings exist. And if it turns out that artificial intelligence is smarter than human beings, so be it. It doesn't really, I think, impact the religion or the Torah. The one thing I'll add is, I'm sure you guys are familiar, but is Roger Penrose has this amazing argument. I think it's in Shadows of the Mind, maybe the Emperor's New Mind. He also has it there first. We're just showing that you can't say that the human mind is an algorithm. We're certainly not computers. We're not just an algorithm, a set of formal rules with certain axioms that you, through logical steps, we come up with our ideas. We're not just such a complex computer. And it's like an ingenious argument that Penrose makes based on the Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And I'm not going to go through it now, but it's essentially he shows, Gödel showed that there are going to be certain truths that we know to be true, but an algorithm could not possibly know them to be true. So any formal system, there will be truths that are obvious to our mind are true, but that formal system itself couldn't prove. And that just shows that our mind uses some method of knowledge, of understanding, of truth verification that is beyond the capability of an algorithm. So we can know our minds are not algorithms. Now, what exactly our minds are, how they work, is it a separate substance given to us by God? Is it a potential in the physical that's actualized? It's just, these are the deep areas of philosophy. And again, it's like unfortunate, but modern science really hasn't been able to really shed any light that would enable us to really know how AI really impacts that.
Ellie, maybe a follow-up here. Sometimes secular scientists would say, well, there are these very difficult issues to explain, like the origin of life, the origin of consciousness, even to some extent, the origin of human beings. But they would kind of push back and say, look, you guys as religious scholars have been thinking about these things for a couple thousand years, but give science enough time and we're going to be able to explain these things. Do you give that sentiment to be acceptable, or do you think, I think what's behind it is kind of the God of the gaps. You're pushing God when just give science time.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So we take that up a few times in throughout our podcast series, the issue of the God of the Gaps issue. And we really think that it's part of what differentiates, I think, the arguments from biology and the arguments for physics. See, because in biology is a like an emergent science. It's not fundamental. It emerges from physics, from chemistry, which emerges from physics. And in a certain sense, the argument from life, it's saying is, how is it that life has emerged? And there's theories that it emerged original DNA somehow. They're still trying to figure out how you had an original replicator. And then there's the process of evolution, which unfolds to be able to lead to the diversity of life. And does it fully work? No, it has holes and it has gaps. And there may be big gaps, small gaps. There's arguments. But the question is, maybe science will be able to fill those gaps. And that's where I think that type of an argument goes, to say it's God of the gaps, is you have a gap somewhere. Like, again, evolution on some level seems to be solid, but now the question is, does it go all the way, or is it too much? Is it able to form new species? Or there's problems. And that's the question, is the path need God to, so to speak, push it along, or does it work? And that's where I think it is a reasonable question. Is that a God of the gaps? Do you really have evidence that that your argument is kind of coming from the absence of being able to fill in those gaps? So I think that it does have, it does hold water. It's, you know, we're not biologists, and to the degree to which that does or doesn't work, I know that there's a lot of debate on both sides of that issue. So we don't really take a stand on that. But when you deal with physics, you're dealing with the foundation of our universe. The very laws are built into the very fabric of our universe. They're fundamental. The fundamental laws of our universe are unchanging. As far as we know, the constants of nature are constant. They're always the same. Every single electron has the same mass. The fine structure constants, whenever we measure it throughout the entire history of the universe, is always 1/137.1399937, whatever. So the idea is that these are, they're not gaps. These are the foundations of the universe themselves. And when we study these foundations, we're looking to find the cause of these foundations. We discover fine tuning, and we discover this has the signature of intelligence. And that's not a gap. That's what the knowledge of the foundations, the fundamentals of our universe point to, the idea of an intelligence. And I think to say that's not a gap in our knowledge, that's the core where the science is pointing. So I think that's why the argument from physics, I think, doesn't fall prey to those types of problems.
Aaron, maybe a follow-up. When you talk about an algorithm, some of my neuroscience friends, some of my philosopher of mind friends, they think that AI may in reality kind of mimics human thinking, but it's not genuine human thinking. Is that kind of where you're coming from as well?
Yeah, that's really, if you really look at Penrose's Emperor's New Mind and the Shadows of the Mind, that's exactly, it's exactly his point. Like there's just the way the human mind knows something, and there's a way a computer knows something. Now, what does a computer knows something? At the very least, it means if I type something in and it spits something back, it knows the answer. So however the computer knows something, it's knowing it through an algorithm. An algorithm means you have, it's like this formal process with defined, well-defined steps that you can go from, you know, the premises, the axioms to a certain conclusion. And there are plenty of people who believe that the human brain is just this complicated algorithm, which instead of running on, you know, on like, you know, computer chips, it's running on neurons and you know, synapses, things like that. But the argument from Penrose is then if we were simply an algorithm, it would be impossible to know certain truths that we know are true, but we can see through Gödel's theorem that it's impossible for any algorithm to know is true. Any formal system that's capable of, you know, of doing arithmetic, there are going to be certain truths which it can't prove. It can't prove or disprove, but then we see it with our own mind is true. So you just see that our minds are not computers. Mm-hmm. Now, just because our minds are not computers doesn't mean that computers don't have something like a mind. It could be a different type of mind. Just like you could argue there's human consciousness and animals have a certain type of consciousness. Like, you know, it's a reasonable thing to think other mammals have some form of consciousness, but it doesn't mean it's a human type of consciousness. So, you know, AI has some sort of intelligence. It's just definitely we are not computers. We're not just more complex computers. That's Penrose's argument. And again, it's really a compelling argument. But it doesn't mean that a computer is not some other type of thing, you know, and it's more than just things moving, you know, part little physical things moving. There could be something else there. I do believe in terms of, you know, your question you just asked before, I do think this is the type of area where you say science does surprise you continuously. You give scientists time, and it is a kind of thing that you could be hopeful that science will make breakthroughs and will start to understand. You know, neuroscience really is, I don't know, a couple decades old. It's one of the youngest of all the sciences, and they've made tremendous breakthroughs and advances in different parts of the brain. Yes, they haven't really explained consciousness at all, or they're far away on the one hand, but on the other hand, they're advancing. So who's to say? I do think this is one of the areas where, you know, give science time, however long, you know, it might take a while, but it's the type of thing that hopefully as we gain knowledge, we'll have a better, you know, much better insight into our own minds and our own consciousness, what that means.
But that being said, I just want to add is that I don't think we're capable of proving it from first principles, but at the same time, I think that it's our position or the Torah's position that the the human intellect and our ability to think is a divine gift that God created man in the image of God. And he gave us the ability to think and to gain knowledge and to probe the mysteries of his universe and of his Torah. And our thinking is a gift from God, but how exactly it operates, again, is part of the mysteries of how it works. And I don't think we really have a model to understand. Could it be modeled in a way similar to AI? Or again, Penrose is saying not quite. But again, I do think that's it's just one thing to maintain that we have the divine image and we were created in God's image. Another thing to prove that from science to somebody who's not coming from that standpoint. So it's hard to make such an argument.
One more question in here. I'm not sure if you're comfortable responding to this, but Fuz Rana, our biochemist here, the president of Reasons to Believe, he's very fond of the argument that humans are exceptional, that there appears to be a difference between human beings and the animal kingdom, not merely in degree, but in kind. In Judaism, would the image of God carry that idea that there's something exceptional about human beings? I mean, some people would say we're religious, or I mean, animals don't invent the natural sciences. Does the image of God in the Hebrew scriptures convey the idea that humans are distinct in kind?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. That you know, it's the Tselem Elokim, the image of God, is something that's given to us by God. You know, the verse says, "Vayipach ba'apov," God blew it into man. You know, it's a metaphor, obviously, on a certain level, but there is something that distinguishes us in a qualitative sense from animals. It's not necessarily easy to prove. You're not going to prove it to a skeptic, but there is, you don't see monkeys, you know, thinking about general relativity. There is something unique about the human mind that's obvious. It's hard to prove, but yeah, definitely from Judaism, from the scriptures, from definitely the oral law, the humans are exceptional and unique and different in a qualitative sense from animals. But it's not so easy to prove that to a skeptic, because it's hard to know when it's just a lot. Like, sometimes quantity becomes a quality at a certain point. It's hard to prove that there's really something substantially qualitatively different there, as opposed to just being a tremendous quantity that seems that way. But, you know, when we don't have definitive knowledge from science, and that's a perfectly, you know, that's exactly where you have the Torah comes in, and it tells us that there is something special and unique about humans in a qualitative sense.
In a moral sense, I mean, Christians tend to emphasize that image of God really means that human beings have kind of an inherent dignity and moral worth. My study of Islam, I seem uncertain as to whether Muslims believe human beings are made in the image of God. But in a Jewish context, does that image carry that significance in terms of our moral value as human beings?
Yeah, I think so. I think that in a certain sense, that's one way to interpret the idea of that God, the man is created, but sound in the image of God, is that I think that when one looks at animal intelligence, one could make a case that animals are, in a certain sense, guided by their instincts. And they're just following, you know, they may exhibit intelligence, but there's a certain amount of training or instinctual patterning, maybe algorithmic type of training, which could lead them towards going to climb a tree and get the banana and whatever tools they might use. But I think in human beings, we beyond just our instincts, there's a part of man which seeks out knowledge and truth and is drawn to truth for its own sake. And that idea of what I quote back to the beginning is the idea of Einstein is like we're a commitment to knowledge for its own sake, that there's this divine element which is part of us which is just interested in truth and in looking for knowledge and which ultimately discovering God. And that there's in a certain sense, we have the capacity to ponder truth and reality and knowledge and to form models and theories of God's wisdom. And I think that's something which is unique to man. In that sense, I think there is a superiority of man in that sense over the animal kingdom. And that's why I think there is a although there's, you know, we treat all of God's creations with a certain degree of respect, everything is God's will, and there's prohibitions against torturing animals or things like that. But at the same time, there is a sense of man is distinct and unique, and there's a dignity or sanctity of human life that we have to respect human beings and protect human beings because we do occupy a certain place in God's universe.
Very good. As a non-scientist, when I think about science, I think that observation and experimentation are incredibly important. That's one reason why I think things like the multiverse are puzzling to me. I guess this question relates to the issue of maybe the limits of science. Some people would suggest that science doesn't have the capacity to maybe to speak to metaphysical issues or ethical issues or aesthetic considerations. Some philosophers would even say that even the scientific method itself didn't come from science. It relies upon certain philosophical assumptions.
Right.
I wonder what your thoughts are. It seems that scientism is often supported by some of the leading secular scientists. I wonder what your thoughts generally on this topic are.
Yeah, I think I would largely agree with that sentiment that there's the area which lends itself to the scientific method. So critical to the scientific method is the hypothesis, the experiment, and the observation. And that's really, you know, Galileo maybe introduced it, maybe Bacon, about comparing your theories to reality. And it provides such a good check on wild speculative theories that, you know, human beings are capable of coming up with. When you say, okay, that's an interesting theory you've come up with, but go compare it to the world, the objective reality out there, and see if you find the correspondence, if it works out. And that's what really allowed the whole scientific endeavor to take off, because you could build consensus now. Because, you know, if in philosophy, everybody argues their own points, and even if one of them, you know, makes more sense than the other, you know, everybody's egos gets involved and nobody accepts it. But over here in science, you have this ability to say, well, look, let's just compare it. Let's see who's theory is confirmed by the experiment. And then you build scientific consensus, and you could, one generation can accept the conclusions of the other, and they could build on it. And that's really what got modern science moving, was this whole methodology. And that method just doesn't work when it comes to, you know, like you were saying, the, you know, ethical truths or aesthetic judgments or the very scientific method itself. And in an ironic, it's true. The scientific method itself is a type of philosophy, and you can't really test it out. There are definitely limitations. And I would say, especially when you're doing philosophy that doesn't lend itself to the scientific method, that's exactly when you have to be the most, you know, that you have to have the most proper training and proper thinking and use logic and not go off on a wild speculative chase. Because when you're doing philosophy or metaphysics, you don't have the ability to compare it to reality in order to check out what you're saying is right. And therefore, any wild speculative theory has to be rejected as being poor philosophy. As opposed to when you're doing science, it could be a wild, crazy theory, but if it works out, you can accept a crazy theory. Quantum mechanics, there are very few things that are crazier than quantum mechanics, but everybody accepts it as true. And how do you, if quantum mechanics was a philosophical theory about this new type of causality that's not deterministic, philosophers would never accept it. It's just a crazy type of theory, but it works. It's true. You test it out and there's consequences, and that's why it's accepted, because of the scientific method. And in a sense, the scientific method allows you to accept a wild, crazy theory because you can test it out. While in philosophy, since you don't have that test, you have to really use your mind and really stay on track and not say crazy things. That's, you know, that's like you're saying, the multiverse. The problem with the multiverse is it's not testable. There's no observation of these infinite other universes. Scientists are trying to speculate about things that are beyond the physical universe. And what they're really doing is philosophy. They call it science, but it's not science because it doesn't follow the classic scientific method. And there are a lot of scientists who say that. And they're doing philosophy, and they're doing bad philosophy. It's poor philosophy because they think they're doing science. They're really doing philosophy. And then they think that because they formulate it mathematically, you know, philosophical theory formulated mathematically somehow can be crazy. and really, you know, an infinite number of unobservable dimensions where everything, of unobservable universes where everything happens, is a wild, crazy philosophical theory, and that's why it should be rejected. And it's you know, you need, in order to really accept something that's wild and crazy, you got to be able to test it out and observe it and to prove it. And if that's exactly the point why we, you know, don't like the multiverse.
I just want to say that we're not, well, he's talking, you know, strongly. We're in the next season of our podcast, which is yet to be released. We're going to take multiverse seriously. So we do think in a certain sense it's crazy. At the same time, we can't, you know, we're telling that to you, but we take it much more seriously, and we go into their arguments and spell out their premises and their supports. And, you know, so this is kind of the conclusion. It kind of sounds crazy, but it does. There are great scientists who maintain and hold by it, and therefore it does have to be taken seriously. And we do take it seriously, and we take it apart very carefully, seriously. And ultimately, this is Aaron's expressing our conclusion, but we don't start with that conclusion. That's kind of the way we start feeling that conclusion, but then we have a great respect for the scientists who maintain it, and we take it very seriously. And then at the end of the day, we kind of come to that conclusion. So, you know, you can stay tuned for season two to see, but. You know, we're not just, you know, when we first started out in Multiverse, that was 10 years ago, that was kind of our attitude. It was just like, this is crazy. I can't believe they're believing in, sounds like science fiction. And it does sound that way. And it's important to still give them the benefit of the doubt and go through rigorously and verify, you know. So that is what we're going to take up. So, but again, it's the point is in these areas, it's very important to be very careful and methodical in one's thinking. Because we don't have the grounding. We're not claiming God is a scientific theory, nor is multiverse a scientific theory. And they're both philosophical conclusions which result from science. Science points us to a problem, to a mystery of fine-tuning. And there's two solutions. One is that they're intelligently designed by God. The other is that there's infinitely many universes out there, and we're just in the one. We have an observer bias that allows us to happen to be in the one lucky universe. And those are two philosophical explanations for the scientific discovery of fine-tuning. And we developed carefully formulated, rigorous philosophical arguments, not scientific arguments, philosophical arguments that the proper conclusion to draw is that it's caused by God, an intelligent cause, and multiverse is not the proper conclusion. But that's, you know, that's what to discuss there.
Follow-up question about the limits of science. Let me contrast two things I've read. Lawrence Krauss, the outspoken atheist and physicist, he said that experimentation is the arbiter of truth. It almost seemed like, and I thought immediately, did you get that out of an experiment? Did the experiment tell you that only an experiment, you can only believe in
Right, it's
experiments?
always the problem.
Right.
But there's other people like Paul Davies, a physicist. He wrote a popular article in the New York Times where he said that kind of everybody, including scientists, when they do science, they have a world view. They think there's a real world out there. They think that their cognitive faculty and their sensory organs are reliable enough to go and discover truth. Any thoughts about those kind of conflicting views back and forth?
What do you mean the conflict between whether science explains everything or there's other areas outside of it? Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you that it's fairly obvious that there are other areas that don't lend themselves to the scientific method. And in order, scientists have a disdain for philosophy. And I don't know when maybe it started around Feynman's time a little bit, and it was. I don't think it's always been the case. And that attitude of looking down on philosophy has kind of caused a lot of scientists to want to make everything science. But in order to do that, you do injury to science because you start changing what the scientific method is in order to allow things that aren't really subject to experimentation to become science. Like the multiverse, they say is science. It's not really, doesn't really come under the normal scientific method. And they want to change the very definition of science from its classic definition that works so well in order to accommodate infinite number of parallel universes. So I think it's just, you know, to me it's obvious that there are certain areas that we can know with our minds and we could see their truth, and they're certainly important to us. Ethics is obviously one of the most important examples there. You know, history, arguably, you know, historical truths, you can't test them again. So there's a lot of areas that are clearly important that we can know them to be true, maybe not the same level of truth as, you know, physics, but still, you know, enough that we live our life by them, we're convinced by them, and they're important, and that they're just not subject to the scientific method. And you're not doing science any favors to try to make science explain everything. It just you end up distorting science and losing what's valuable about it. And it's, I think it's just a bad idea.
This last question, I guess I'm kind of inviting you to speak to it as rabbis, as people who have faith in God. My father was a combat soldier in the Second World War, and his infantry division helped liberate a Jewish concentration camp in Germany. And I remember being a boy looking at these Time Life books and just seeing images of the Holocaust. And I just found it very difficult to get my mind around evil at that magnitude. There are many Christians, I think, who want to show their support for Jewish people, for the nation of Israel. I'm troubled by the anti-Semitism I see here in America at some of the elite universities and around the world. How would you suggest that Christians show their respect and appreciation for the Jewish people, for Jewish tradition, and for traditional Judaism as a whole?
Right. Thank you. I just want to thank you for your father and for your attitude and your your kind support, and especially at this difficult time in with what's going on in Israel and what's going on in America. And it is very difficult. And, you know, I think there's often an impression, and maybe you guys, you could help with this, is that there's an impression in the world, there's a lot of anti-Semites or people who are very outspoken against Jews and against Israel and against what Israel's right to defend itself. And maybe sometimes they're the loudest voice, but even though they're loud and they're protesting and there's a lot of, hate going around, I don't think that really represents the majority in our country. And I think there are many people like yourself and other Christians who recognize the fact that they respect what Israel's right to defend itself, and the fact that the dignity of that we are being attacked, and give Jews treatment the same way you treat other people throughout the world, and other people who are being attacked and oppressed and having rockets hurled at them. And so I think that maybe one thing which could be done is that it's helpful for us, and I know it gives us and our friends and family who are in Israel just the sense that we know that we have other people who got our back and who support us, and they stand up for us, whether it be to buying an Israeli flag or putting it on social media. I saw that a few months ago, that you supported Israel, I think. Yeah, and we appreciate that. And it goes a long way, because sometimes people get the impression that America is against Jews because of the fact there's so many people who are yelling and screaming and all that. And I think it goes a long way to show support. And if there's demonstrations against anti-Israel demonstrations, perhaps someone could start a pro-Israel demonstration, or just to show that there are voices and there are people. Again, the Jews are obviously going to support Israel, and we respect America and we respect Israel and respect the Jewish people. But it's helpful to show that there are other Christians like yourself, and we have a lot of friends in America, and it's very helpful, I think, to show the world that there we do have support, and that there are people who aren't on our side, who are objectively looking at what's going on and recognizing that we deserve to, we have a right to defend ourselves, and that there's something immoral and unethical going on with the terror, the way we're being attacked, and the terrorism, the brutality. And again, I think it goes a long way to show people that you do support us, and we certainly appreciate anything you guys do.
Right. Yeah, I would just one thing correction. It's not just that we have a right to defend ourselves. I think Jews in Israel have an obligation to defend ourselves. And, you know, the Nazis were evil, and Hamas is the same kind of evil, where their entire existence is just to eradicate the Jewish state. And there's an obligation to really eradicate that kind of evil from the world. So I really, it's more than just a right. I would say also for Christians is, one thing you can do if you're financially able to is go to Israel, take a trip. If you're able to go to Israel and see Israel yourself, as opposed to just, you know, hearing about it on the news or reading about it, or, you know, encountering a Jew in America, just go to Israel, and you know, you when you go to Israel, you'll help Israel economically. You know, tourism helps Israel economically, and it's just an amazing country. The land is beautiful. It's the holy land. It's of you know of scriptures, and it's the people in Israel are incredible. They're just saying, you'll see that there's these amazing people. It's full of life. It's full of energy. It's really the most unique country. It's Jews from all over the world who were scattered for thousands of years coming together to form one society. It has this kind of a state, this kind of a nation. It hasn't existed in the modern world. It's never really existed. There's something so special about the actual going to Israel and seeing it for yourself. And that, I think, really it'll benefit Israel economically, but it also for Christians who go there, it can transform your life when you with the land and the people, and it will be beneficial for any individual who is able to go, and it'll be beneficial for the Jews and for Israel. And I think that's just, you know, one option for those who have the time or the financial ability to do if they can.
Well, I just want to tell both of you how honored we are to have you on our program. I'm impressed with your scientific substance, and you also speak so clear about these topics. I've only listened to two podcasts, but I'm going to go back and listen to more. And you know, we'd like to have you on again. Reasons to Believe has another science podcast. We have a scholar community. There are many people in the scholar community that have, you know, Jewish roots, and I know they would love to talk with you. So, Joe, this has been a real honor for us, and I'm just so glad you contacted us. I consider these some of the best shows we've done.
Wow. Yeah, thank you.
I really, really appreciate that. It means a lot to us.
Yeah, definitely. We really enjoyed ourselves here.
All right.
All right, that's going to wrap it up. Thanks to our guests, Rabbis Eli Feder and Aaron Zimmer. Be sure to listen to their podcast, Physics to God. All right, and let us know your comments and questions. You can reach out to Ken on X, that's at RTB_KSamples, and we'll be glad to read your comment or question here. Get clear thinking sent to your device by subscribing to the Reasons to Believe podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and most podcast services. For Ken Samples and our guests, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Clear Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.